Hey, welcome back. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our program, it's another edition of What You Got Cooking. My guests will be the African-American culinary historian Michael Twitty. He's the author of a new book called The Cooking Gene, and Chef David Thomas. He's the executive chef at Ida B's Table, a great restaurant here in Baltimore. Linnell and I were just there on Saturday night. Plus, I'll speak with the great documentary filmmaker Stanley Nelson. His latest film traces the history of historically black colleges and universities. It'll be shown on PBS next week, and we'll get a preview tomorrow here on Midday. So I hope you can join us then. If you've just joined us today, we're talking about immigration. Joining me now is Dr. Perla Guerrero. She's an assistant professor of American Studies and U.S. Latina and Latino Studies at the University of Maryland in College Park. Her new book is called Nuevo South, Latinas, Asians, and the Remaking of Place. Professor, welcome to Midday. Thanks for your time.
Thank you for having me.
So Nuevo South, you write that this is the newest manifestation of the New South. What do folks mean in your community, the community of scholars that look at this kind of thing? What do they mean by Nuevo South as opposed to the New South?
So the New South is an idea that has been written about in history, in the field of history. And boosters after the Civil War said that the region was made anew, the region was no longer racist or as racist, that it was a region that offered equal opportunity to black, white people to make a go of it. And so what historians have done is challenge this idea, this boosterism, and that actually what happened in the South after the Civil War was what we would now call a rebranding. Or the changing same, that the region was still quite racist, institutions were still quite prejudiced, but they were no longer as open about that. So the reason why I say that this is a Nuevo South, when scholars talk about the Nuevo South, they're referring to the migration and the growth of Latinos in the South, something that started occurring in the 1980s and really started taking off in the 1990s. However, I should note that other scholars like Julie Weiss write about the Latino communities that existed in the South as early as 1910. So it's not to say that this community didn't exist in the South prior to the 1990s, but that there's been a dynamic growth of Latinos in this region since the 1980s and the 1990s. And so the work that I do in bridging the gap between New South and Nuevo South scholarship is really articulating the connection in terms of also a kind of rebranding of the South as, again, claiming that it's no longer as racist as it used to be, but actually relying on the exploitation of, in this case, often immigrants or refugees that are working in work like the poultry industry. So it's really creating a link that exists in the region, but really giving it a kind of proper name.
And you write in your book about the different experiences of Vietnamese immigrants, Cuban immigrants, and Mexicans, particularly in Arkansas, where you yourself grew up as a kid before you went to, or you actually went to college in Arkansas as well.
I did.
Before you did your graduate work. And you talk about the racialization of these groups. What do you mean by the term racialization? Because it's obvious that that's a very important dimension to the current immigration debate. Race has all to do with what folks are discussing in today's immigration debate. But what does the term mean in a scholarly sense?
Right. So racialization refers to the way in which people take visual cues like hair texture or color, like skin color or features, to identify somebody as being of a particular racial group or ethnic group. And in addition to those markers, we also look at dress. So the clothing that somebody wears, the way they style their hair, and then there's also additional work being done in sound studies on accents, the importance of sound in determining somebody's racial background. So the term racialization refers to those markers that we take in, and then the conclusion we reach about a particular group or groups of people based on based on only the things that we take in. So it's important in the field of Latino studies and in the field of ethnic studies more broadly, because this is a process that often occurs from the outside in, meaning there's a person that's essentially judging somebody based on what they look or what they sound like, without the person actually speaking to their own history or saying explicitly that they are Vietnamese or Cubans or Mexican. And so this process also, the process of racialization is really important because it changes over time and it changes in different places. So in the book, for example, I open with the fact that I grew up in suburban Los Angeles where everyone knew that I was Mexican, they assumed that I was Mexican, and then I moved to Arkansas, and there people thought that I was Vietnamese because Southeast Asians were the only non-black and non-white group present. So because I didn't fit this idea of a black person or this idea of a white person, the default was that I had to be Southeast Asian. And then, again, that changed when I moved to college to an area that didn't have a large Southeast Asian community, and there are people that I was white. So I was racialized as Southeast Asian, then I was racialized as white, even within the state, within the same state over a span of just a couple of years.
You also write about the fact that the literature on racialization points out that it has long been a way of organizing society. Is there a distinction between racialization and profiling?
There is a distinction. The distinction is that racialization is not inherently bad. The problem isn't seeing difference or seeing that somebody looks visually different than somebody else or gender difference. The issue is the power that an individual has to, for example, stop somebody, let's say a young black male, because they quote unquote look suspicious. You have the process of racialization at play, but the real difficulty is the institution police officer, law enforcement officer works for that allows this to continue to happen. Or in the case of Latinos, you increasingly have them being stopped for a broken taillight, and the problem is when the law enforcement agency is working with immigration and customs enforcement to try to deter undocumented immigration. So they're related, but they're not the same thing.
We have a listener who's sent in an email. Michael writes, why, even after being very picky about the words used by others, your guest and most liberals don't understand that most conservatives are opposed to illegal immigration. If you come here legally and make a life for yourself, you have my admiration and respect, and I welcome you. So how would you respond to that listener, this notion of illegal, undocumented versus documented?
So there's the historian in me would say that history matters. So the idea of illegal immigration is something that's fairly recent. The historian May Nye wrote a short op-ed piece in the Los Angeles Times in 2006, and it's called "How Grandma Got Legal." And in that piece, she writes that in the early 20th century, the government excluded just 1% of the 25 million immigrants who landed at Ellis Island before World War I. So in today's contemporary moment, we think that illegal immigration has always existed and that people's grandparents, you know, did it the right way. But actually, the United States had very porous open borders. And you had to either be racially excluded the way the Chinese immigrants were, or have other reasons for exclusion, like health reasons. So in today's contemporary moment, we're really missing the longer historical scope. The other thing to consider at this moment is that undocumented immigration occurs because the United States relies on undocumented laborers. If laborers were not able to get jobs here, they would do what conservative people want, which is self-deport. But that's not the case. They are hired at construction sites. They're hired to take care of children. They're hired to take care of elders. And that decision is something that is driven by economic goals, meaning that a business wants to have a worker that a business wants to have a worker and wants to pay them the least that they can pay them. And oftentimes, undocumented immigrants serve that purpose. So it's in part a revolving door because there's a need for their work.
Yeah, and Michael, I would point you to the fact that Mr. Trump has proposed a number of restrictions on legal immigration. He's not just talking about undocumented people, but, for example, we were just talking about this in the last segment, this notion of chain migration, or as people on the left side of the aisle refer to it as family reunification, is legal. And Mr. Trump wants to end that practice. He says that's not a good idea. So his focus is not just on people who are here without documentation. His focus is also on other people. Greg in Butchers Hill writes, "When my ancestors came to this country, they followed the rules, except there were no rules. If you needed a job and there weren't enough jobs at home, you got on a boat to the U.S. where the jobs were. As long as you didn't have some infectious disease or Chinese ancestry, as you've mentioned, Professor, you were in." And again, the rules of immigration, like predating 1924, there were zero rules. And then after that, they have evolved over time. Let's see if we can get another couple of calls. Charlotte in Baltimore, welcome to Midday.
Yes, thank you. And thank you, Tom, and thank you, your guest. I appreciate your talking about racialization. And I'd like to refer listeners to a book by Stephen Tillett called Stop Falling for the Okey-Doke, in which he dissects the entire myth of races. We are one human race, and we're different ethnicities, and he lays that out very well. So
all right,
I just wanted to bring that up.
Thanks for that call, Charlotte. I appreciate it. And Professor Guerrero, you write about the scaling of this racialization and whether or not the national dialogue about immigration and racialization influences the conversations in local communities and vice versa, the way that the experience of people in northern Arkansas, which you write about, how that influences the national debate. Tell us what your studies found about that.
Right. So one of the things that I found in conducting my research is related to the anecdote I shared earlier about being racialized as Vietnamese. So when my family moved to Northwest Arkansas, there weren't a lot of Latinos, there weren't a lot of Mexican immigrants, but yet Arkansans did have an idea of who undocumented or who illegal aliens were, but there was a disconnect. They couldn't readily identify me or my family as fitting this particular kind of category. However, as more Latinos moved to the area and there was locally a realization of realization that this group of people is who constitutes Latinos or undocumented immigrants or illegal aliens, then they started to act, Arkansans started to act much more strongly in terms of policing space or the use of parks. And you see this dialectical process where national ideas of illegal immigration filtered down to the local area, even though Arkansans didn't really or readily identify the Mexicans amongst them, but there's usually a tipping point when kids start to go to public schools or when families start to use more public spaces, where the community realizes that these newcomers are who they have been told to fear, and so they start acting in fearful ways, policing them, harassing them, et cetera. So that's the influence of the national dialogue on local communities and the way in which a local community kind of absorbs what the national media is telling them.
And you talk about how different immigrant communities achieve different status, if you will, in various places. You talk about how in Arkansas in 1975, the end of the Vietnam War, a number of Vietnamese immigrants came and they were housed at a place called Fort Chaffee in mm-hmm. Arkansas, and that the number of people housed at that point actually exceeded the number of people who lived in the county at that time. And now those Vietnamese immigrants are considered, the term you use is the model immigrant community. And you talk about a very different reception for Cubans, for example, who came just 5 years later in 1980 when Bill Clinton was the governor of Arkansas. So there seems to be some way, some magical way that there's this hierarchy of immigrant classes that, that's at play here.
Right. So in the case of Vietnamese in 1975, they were both Vietnamese in 75 and Cubans from Mariel in 1980 were fleeing communist dictatorships. But the Vietnamese were reluctantly welcomed. Of course, we had been heavily involved in Vietnam, and so part of the reason they were reluctantly accepted is because a lot of Americans felt that we owed the Vietnamese something. Cubans, however, because Cubans in 1980 were largely Afro-Cuban, meaning they have African ancestry, and this was also a group of Cubans that grew up under Castro's regime, they were constructed as being suspicious, as likely to be communists, and of course the issue of race, especially in a state like Arkansas, also came to the forefront. So what ended up happening with the Vietnamese is that in the contemporary moment, in relationship to Latino immigrants, Vietnamese are constructed as model minorities, meaning that their caste is the ones that did the work, that learned the language, that, you know, are exemplary of the kind of people that we want. But in doing that, people erase the history, which was that a lot of the Vietnamese that came in 1975 were actually professionals in their home country. They already came, the majority of them came already speaking English, and that Fort Chaffee offered English language courses, something which, of course, Latino immigrants don't benefit from. There's not a massive program to help them Americanize, let's say. So that's what's happening with those two groups.
Well, Dr. Guerrero, we're going to have to call it a day at this point, but I very much appreciate your the work that you did and the research in this book, and you're taking the time to speak with us today. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Perla Guerrero is on the faculty of the University of Maryland. Her new book is called Nuevo South, Latinas, Asians, and the Remaking of Place. Coming up after a quick break, Maria Elena Hincapié of the National Immigration Law Center joins me to continue our conversation about immigration. But before we take that break, on Mondays here on Midday, it is our practice to read the names of the people who've lost their lives to violence in the previous week. We stand in witness to their untimely deaths, and we remember their families and friends in their hour of grief. So far this year, 27 people in Baltimore City have lost their lives to violence. That number is unchanged from last week, since the organizers of the Baltimore ceasefire put together their third series of events 10 days ago. No new homicides have been reported in the city of Baltimore. The names of three young men who were killed the week before last have now been released by the police. They are Raymond Wyatt, age 42, Vashon Conyers, age 30, and Jarrell Bryce. He was 27 years old. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is Your Public Radio, member supported 88.1 WYPR.